From PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. Two people were killed in Papua New Guinea's highlands region after an ambush on a convoy carrying two national MPs in Hela province. Last Tuesday, the Hela governor, Francis Pote, was traveling through Como with the higher education ministers, Francis Morris, when their convoy came upon a blockade. The MPs' vehicles were forced to turn around, although the men in another convoy of vehicles was able to identify as an enemy by a tribesman manning the blockade. The MPs got away unhurt, but two people died in the subsequent shootout and the policeman was injured. Hela Province's police commander Mike Wella told Johnny Blades about the attack on the convoy.
Just before they reached Como, about 3 kilometers away, they had a roadblock by one of these clans. And obviously they had a tip-off from some informants along the way that one of their enemies were in one of the trucks in the convoy. So with that, they set up the roadblock, and then when the convoy came in contact with the people there at the roadblock, they asked if they could go through, but they refused to allow the governor and the minister and the convoy that was there to pass through to Como. So the governor had to turn around, him and the minister in the same vehicle, turn around to drive back, and then when in doing so, at this back, the warring faction set all the vehicles, even the police vehicle as well, and spotted the enemy. Told about him, obviously shot him. He was an ex-counselor related to the other clan that they were fighting against.
Yeah. And then there was a shootout.
And then they shot him, and then realizing that even the police there were outnumbered and outgunned, they just had to retreat together with those other in the convoy. And in doing so, one other innocent guy who happens to be in the convoy and was driving a vehicle, they shot him and he just went off to the drain and obviously died. So there was two killed that day. In the process of the retreat, our policeman exchanged fire with the clansman, and one of our guys got shot on the shoulder and on the eyebrow. He's recovering now in the hospital.
I'd heard that 4 people were killed in the total event.
Negative. That was another incident of a tribal fight that had 4 killed in 2 days that they were fighting. This was not a total different incident. Not the one that got these guys ambushed, set up a roadblock and shot the enemy.
Can I just confirm whether people from Lagame were involved in the blockade or the ambush?
Yes, they were. People at Lagame are the ones responsible for the road blockade, and even now they're still blocking road. I've talked to our leaders in Como to try and get them to try and negotiate with them to let the road open, given that we have other innocent public traveling in and out from Como now being victimized because of their own, their fight and all that. I'm hoping that they do get the road cleared today. If that fails, obviously I'll have to use police to go in and open up the road.
There's a report, though, that the mobile unit went up to Lagame the next day and destroyed a lot of houses and property. What about that?
Mobile squad was asked to go in there to go in search of the suspect. Obviously, they went there and everybody did them, so obviously 1 or 2 houses were put up in flames, yeah.
Because they were hiding the perpetrators?
Yes, the perpetrators, and those ones were believed to be house or the houses that were housing the perpetrators doing this illegal stuff. Yeah.
8 police officers and 1 military officer who were convicted of rape and sexual assault in Fiji have been sentenced up to 9 years in jail. The 9 men attacked 2 prisoners, one of whom, Veselak Soko, died of his injuries in 2014. The other victim, Senejile Bula, survived. As Karori Vanuatu reports, despite the sentencing, the case is far from over.
The father of Vileke Sesoko says the prison sentences given to his son's assailants were lenient after the convicted men were given jail time of between 7 and 9 years at the High Court in Lautoka. The lawyer for the men, Iqbal Khan, had initially sought a stay application to delay the sentencing, but Judge Justice Aruna Aluthki instead ordered Mr. Khan to pay a penalty, saying the application amounted to an intention to obstruct justice. However, Jeremiah Soko says the sentences were reduced by 4 years due to mitigation.
At least my family can have some peace at this time, and I feel for the families of these police officers and the army officer. Although they have been sentenced, the court seems to be lenient on that, but we can't do much at this stage. But for my family, we will be taking legal action against the government for compensation sake.
Jeremiah Soko says he does not know if the prison terms will change what he describes as a culture of brutality in the Fiji police force. But a former human rights commissioner says the sentences could deter similar acts of brutality. Shamima Ali says the sentences could encourage the public to report similar crimes.
I think there is a very strong message being sent out and a great wake-up call for security forces, including law enforcement, that you cannot get away with this anymore.
Ms. Ali says the sentences were in keeping with other jail terms given for rape in Fiji, although she would have preferred that they did not include the chance of parole. But if Iqbal Khan's successful, the men could be free within the next year. Mr. Khan's filed an appeal on 40 counts, saying the judge erred in dismissing the evidence of Senejeli Boyla because he was apparently an unreliable witness. He says there's no question over what happened to Mr. Soko, but he says his clients weren't the culprits.
We said that they were assaulted by somebody, but not the accused persons. We are saying that the state has not proved beyond reasonable doubt that this was the persons who had done it. And in fact, Boyler, in his evidence, he gave full names of other officers who assaulted him. What we are saying that the judge should have stopped the case against these guys and directed that somebody else should have been charged. That's our complaint.
Mr. Khan says it was the state witnesses who were unreliable and changed their stories several times.
They didn't make the statement, or they did not sign it, or they did
Despite this fact, the learned judge accepted their version, raising the point that the learned judge did not exercise his discretion judicially. We said the learned judge only took into consideration the state's submission. All the evidence before the court was with very serious doubts. Also, there were approximately 25 to 30 officers that were involved, and we are saying, why are they only selecting the prosecution for 9 men?
The convicted men had been suspended on full pay since February. Mr. Khan says he's not sure of their current status, but believes they should still be getting paid.
Well, I have not been inquired before here.
But since they have filed an appeal, their sentence should not stand now, because they still present as innocent, despite the fact they are convicted by the High Court. They have still got another avenue, the Court of Appeals. All of them, the witnesses' evidence of character given by senior police officers, unblemished reports. The first time they have appeared in a court of law, they were capable men, very capable men, with unblemished records.
Iqbal Khan says he expects the appeal to be heard in the new year. In the meantime, he's planning to apply for bail for the men so they can be released from custody. This is Koro Vakauta.
Solomon Island businesses are being encouraged to help raise awareness about domestic violence. On November 25th was the International Day to Eliminate Violence Against Women and is marked by the White Ribbon Day in several parts of the Pacific. A march that took place in the Solomon Islands capital, Honiara, was supported by a number of businesses and the coordinator of the Chamber of Commerce and Industry, working with the World Bank's International Finance Corporation. Don Wiseman spoke to IFC's Ruth Matela and asked her about the reports of domestic violence in Solomon Islands, if they're far worse than what people have been thinking.
I can first speak as a Solomon Island woman. Based on the research conducted around 2009, by SBC and the Ministry of Women, the research points out that 2 out of every 3 women have experienced violence from an intimate partner or family member. So based on that research, which is not too long ago, it makes me as a Solomon Island woman wonder how many women are out there that have not experienced violence. So that's my question in the forefront. But then, speaking from my project point of view, I would then ask how many women in the workplaces have experienced violence, maybe at home, and do not have supportive employers or businesses to help them get through and still be working. So that's the two sides that I'm coming from.
Yes. You're involved with a World Bank agency, the International Finance Corporation, and working with the Solomon Islands Chamber of Commerce to bring or make businesses aware of the benefits for them and the benefits for society in general if they help in this work to overcome domestic violence. So what is it you're saying to businesses?
Well, as partners in this work, this is a small part of our work that we focus on violence. It's only one part of it. The other part is to help women in the private sector to become strong leaders in their businesses. But what we're saying is that if businesses can recognize that domestic violence affects their employees and therefore it affects their business, then it would benefit them to take a stand and commit to building safe and supportive workplaces. So that's what we are saying. And I think the ISC and Chamber of Commerce partnership is a good model because we are working as partners and we are not working alone. So I feel that it is a good model that it can be replicated anywhere in the Pacific. We are learning from ISC and Coalition for Women in Business in Papua New Guinea. So some lessons have been learned from that project. But in Solomon's, it is quite small, and I think partnership is the best way to go.
Today, to mark White Ribbon Day, and this is marking the first of these 16 days to focus on gender violence,
yes,
you have staged a parade through Honiara involving businesses. Now, did you get good support from the businesses?
Actually, we have two big businesses. This is the first time that businesses have committed this engagement and participation in the White Ribbon Day. So it's a very good turnout. We had Solomon Islands NPF and also Bank South Pacific with all their CEOs and managers and a lot of people out there with their corporate uniforms. So that's really good. And we also have other small businesses like HKL and Soul Rise and a few more small businesses. So for the first time, it's really good. We have 13 businesses that supported a statement saying that they're against violence against women, including our telecom, ANZ Bank, Forum Fisheries, Bank South Pacific, SINPF, Soul Rise, Soul Brew, Tower Insurance, AJ&G Blums, Nafoka Construction, APTC, and Skill for Economic Growth Program. So those are all members of the Chamber of Commerce.
And do you have a sense that this effort is going to have an immediate impact?
I think so. I believe that everything has a small beginning, and for big businesses like SINPF and BSP to come out and join the march this morning is a great start for not only for the image of Chamber but also their own businesses. Like, I'm thinking good citizenship. So it's a good thing, especially for the country and also for the work environment, so that women in workplaces can see that, yes, our managers are supporting, you know, safe workplaces, so that's good.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from the studios of PCJ Radio International. The new Pacific director for the World Bank says there's massive gains to be made in the Pacific if countries can get things right. Michael Neff will oversee the World Bank's regional portfolio, which includes 55 projects across 13 countries worth than $1 billion U.S. Mr. Keff told Corey Hawkins the bank has identified potential areas which countries could focus on improving and developing, and two major risk areas which need to be migrated to maximize gains across the region.
We looked at what could be gained basically by getting things right on fisheries, on deep sea mining, on tourism, on the knowledge economy, taking advantage of opportunities that they have in terms of labor mobility. We also looked at how to mitigate two major risks. One is, of course, vulnerability to climate change. The other one is the non-communicable disease crisis, in fact, which many of the countries face. And we tried to quantify the benefits of getting these things right. So for many countries, it could make a very, very big difference indeed in terms of per capita revenue. The difference between the business as usual scenario and the getting things right scenario can be quite impressive in many cases. Countries like Kiribati, for example, could basically double their per capita income compared to current trends. And something close to the same applies to Fiji or to Tuvalu, for example. So, you know, the possibility of achieving quite impressive results indeed.
And you're confident that Pacific countries will get things right?
Well, I'm confident that it is possible, I think, to go a long way towards reaping these benefits. You know, whether everything will be done to the absolute best extent, maybe not. But I think that there are things that can certainly be done, which build on initiatives that countries have already taken, which could make a very big difference. Just to give you two examples quickly, one is on fisheries. I think the way fisheries are managed in the Pacific is actually really first rate. It is frontier practices. But there is a possibility to build on that and to use the high degree of technical capacity that has actually been reached in the Pacific on the issue of fishery management and to actually improve upon the current system, which is a collective system of managing what is obviously a shared resource. And doing this would really make a very, very big difference for those countries that are particularly reliant on the revenues that they derive from fisheries, such as Kiribati and Tuvalu, for example. Another example where I believe, or another area where I believe that change is indeed possible, would be on labor mobility. And I think it's not very difficult to imagine that in the future, the number of Pacific Islanders working abroad could grow without in any way putting a strain on receiving countries. And also the type of economic activities in which they would be engaged could diversify beyond horticulture. So old age care is clearly an area where there are increasing needs in countries like Australia, New Zealand, also South Korea, Japan, and where Pacific Islanders could possibly provide services that are needed in those advanced economies, or a number of vocational type of areas, such as you know, working as carpenters, for example, or skills of that type could also open up new areas of opportunities for Pacific Islanders. And the potential income that they could derive is quite enormous. In terms of income derived from overseas employment for the Pacific Islanders who would be working abroad, we are talking of something that could be an additional $12 billion for the Pacific workers by 2040. So very big numbers indeed.
Occupational safety and health remains a critical challenge for workers around the Pacific region. The International Labour Organization says that despite government efforts to reform labour laws across the region, there are still huge gaps in the implementation of the law, policy and practice. Labour inspectors from Cook Island, Tuvalu, Kiribati, Solomon Islands, Tonga, gathered in Auckland last week to learn how to tackle the country's issues. Indira Stewart has more.
Satoshi Sasaki, a specialist from the ILO Office for the Pacific, says the ILO is calling for better protection for workers in the region.
The work should be well protected in that sense as to how the government and together with the employers and workers' organizations to provide well protection of the workers, particularly sometimes in the rural areas, informal sectors, where the workers' voice is not clearly heard. Then as to how we can take more proactive ways to reaching out this population, this is a big challenge.
Mr. Sasaki says there needs to be more enforcement of labour policies.
It's not enough yet. And for the most important thing is that for the employers and workers together, they should know about what are the occupational safety and health, what the standard is, and why it is important, how it affects their operations. Of course, for the to the workers, it means that their own health, but also employers, well, it's their reputation and their productivity.
Last month, the e-Kiribati government announced it was updating the country's labour laws to better apply international labour standards. Rea Aluta, a labour inspector from Kiribati, says the implementation of labour legislation remains a challenge. She also says employers who don't comply with the country's work safety policies have not been penalised.
Most of the companies, they not comply with those acts that they enacted in the Kiribati law. So, yeah, I think it's more, I mean, precisely on how they improve or enforce those laws to the employers to provide safety workplaces for their workers and those basic safety gears during their works.
Moeroa Oreiki Kaikaveka Inoka is a labour inspector from the Cook Islands. He also says there are issues with enforcement of the country's current Employment Act, but the legislation also needs to be reviewed.
We have to look at the OSH policies. We have to review it and also work on it and probably improve or make amendments to cover a wide range of other areas that need to be covered by occupational health and hazards.
Fiji, Kiribati, Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands and Samoa are the only countries that have ratified the 8 fundamental ILO conventions. Satoshi Sasaki says there's still a lot of work to be done in the region. This is Indira Stewart.
And finally on the program, NEO's public broadcaster hopes to have a groundbreaking digital service on air by early next year. The new service has been in the wind for the past few years, and the general manager of BCN, Trevor Tiakia, told Don Wiseman that they are still planning to make 12 channels, digital channels that is, available.
At the moment, we're in the testing phase for the channels that we have been able to acquire rights from.
So you've got quite a number from New Zealand, I think, haven't you?
Yes.
What about sports channels, news channels?
We have also acquired rights for the news channels and also a sports channel. But we have an agreement with BBCL, which was appointed by the New Zealand government to handle all the Pacifica TV. There will be sports coming through that channel in our normal TV news channel.
Now, what it means is everyone's got to switch to digital, don't they? Because you're shutting down analog.
Eventually, we're heading towards that way.
So people are getting little receivers put on their houses at the moment.
Customers will have a UHF antenna and also a set-top box with a card in their homes.
What are the costs to the typical resident?
The cost for the normal TV Nui channel still remains, because that's the annual subscription fee that covers the TV Nui channel. But anything outside of that, the customer pays for the extra channels.
The TV Nui fee is what we might have called in the old days a license fee. How much is that annually?
The license fee is charged at $75 every 3 months.
Okay, and in terms of the charges for channels?
In terms of charges for channels, for example, if you want the news package, that's an additional $15 on top. Entertainment package, that's an extra that the customer needs to pay also.
So that's every 3 months?
That's every 3 months.
You expect everything to be up and running when?
Hopefully when we iron out some fading problems that we have with the outer villages, we'll be able to launch sometimes in the new year.
In Olofi, in the main town Olofi, what's the quality of reception like there?
From Avasele right through to Tui, the signal quality is excellent. But for the remaining villages on the other side, we have a fading signal problem.
Okay, so what's the solution there?
We need to install another couple of antennas on top of our tower that feeds the northern side and increase the power of the transmitter. and also for the southern side.
Okay, you're getting, I know, quite a lot of aid support for this, but it's still it's a very big project for Broadcast New A, isn't it?
Yes, it's big, but we are excited.
Now, before we end today's edition of the program, if you want to contact us and let us know what you think of the program or have any story ideas, it's very easy to do so. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Now, there were those who are listening right now to the weekly transmission of our 30-minute weekly edition of the program in the Americas. Now, if this program is something that you enjoy hearing on shortwave in your region, let us know with the following email address, pcjqsl@pcjmedia.com. Once again, pcjqsl@pcjmedia.com. All your comments, suggestions, and ideas, actually, to keep the program on shortwave will greatly be appreciated. On behalf of the whole team here at the PCJ Radio International Newsroom, I'm Keith Perron wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days. Until next time, so long, and take care.